I call the work session of Cleveland County Board of Supervisors to order. We'll begin with the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by the moment of silence.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. All right. Tonight, we're here for budget review with the agency presentation. First up to bat is number 40, Cleveland County SPCA.
I came a little unprepared, so I'll answer questions the best I can. I was planning to go home and get my paperwork.
So go to 21 budget and go to public animal. Okay, so I can start it off here a little bit, and then I will, Jerry Russell, the president of the FSPCA, she can talk a little bit more about it. So the budget request for fiscal year 20 was total $301,000. There was a big increase from 19 to 20 previously to bring their part-time salaries for their staff up to a level where they could keep them, because they're nominally at around $8 an hour before. So from 19 to 20, there is a big increase. And working with the FSPCA for the last couple years, we determined that nominally 75% of the animals that they house through the FSPCA are related to county-related functions from animal control officers. So we had worked with the FSPCA to kind of come up with a formula for what they say their expenses are, and then we'd kind of fund different categories, whether it's 75%, since we contain 75% of the capacity of the animals in there. So their actual 100% request was $428,000, but after we go through and then we apply the percentages, and then also too that there was this kind of a scheduled increase for some of their staff as well. So my county admin proposal was $330,105, and the current fiscal year is $301,000, so a $29,000 increase. Mm-hmm. Ms. Russell, do you want to add anything to?
Well, the other thing we've gotten a very generous donor that's going to add on a isolation unit for us, so there'll be added cost for insurance and for the utilities. And what happens is the building's so small that we need more space for isolation, because the ones that come in, a lot of them have had ringworm and different infections, and we have to keep them for a certain period of time. And we still would like to increase salaries. We're still below what a lot of county employees are making, and we've had success this year. We haven't had quite as much turnover since we've increased salaries, which has been a great thing, but you know, we're still trying to keep good people, and it's a hard job.
And then from a couple of years ago, I think they're at around $8 an hour.
Yeah.
I think they're up to 11. I think it's 11 now. It should be
10.50.
Okay. And then there was some increases to bring them up a little further throughout this next budget process too. So the big increase.
Plus we're going to have to start having our employees get shots for rabies pre-exposure, since we had that rabies scare this last couple months. So we're trying to keep our expenses down, but medicine keeps going up.
So the biggest increase is generally due to the salary increases, and then some other nominal expenses here and there. But does the board have any questions for Ms. Russell or?
Nope. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We appreciate everything.
And you go back to the budget and pull up Cooperative Extension's budget.
Okay, next is 67, Cooperative Extension, Ms. Mayo.
I'm going to let you know again. I let you know last year. I'm not your interim extension agent, okay? I am your extension agent. I've been your unit coordinator 2 years now. I'm still here, not going anywhere. That said, we do have great news. That position that John Thompson left vacant 2.5 years ago, almost three in May, we are in process now. We are reviewing applications. There were 22, I believe, well-qualified. So I'm looking forward to filling that position finally. Nothing new to report this year, the increase that you see in that contract services line. Just a reminder, you support agents that support Fluvanna County in surrounding counties. So you have an expert in Albemarle, Green, Louisa for agriculture and natural resources, and you also have two family consumer science agents that serve us, one health nutrition and one in financial management. In addition, you're not paying into Faye Anderson. She's 100% grant funded for our low income clientele. And also Brittany Redmond, who is the glue that holds our office together. So Fluvanna does not put dollars towards her position. So that's the major increase. The other changes were very minor, I believe the $20 increase in professional dues and a little bit of a decrease in communications.
So the biggest increase is from fiscal year 20, $102,400 to fiscal year 21, $104,453. You know, a couple thousand dollars, and it's in contractual services, and that's where we reimburse Virginia Tech for their portion of the salaries.
And I can tell you that those increases are directly related to two promotions that are pending. They have both cleared the peer review process. So as soon as the Board of Visitors votes on that in March, they will go through for our next fiscal year. And so we had to front load that, assuming that they will go through because they've already passed the peer review process. So any questions for me?
Ms. Kim, when will the kitchen be in operation? It's a nice kitchen. It's a nice side. You got everything. It's beautiful.
It is a beautiful kitchen, and I believe that we are ready to go.
We're just waiting on
the health department's approval, which needed a couple of pieces, I believe, from Public Works that they are working on. We completed an application together. Aaron submitted it, and they sent us 23 pages of questions. So I thought we did it right. I took the class. I got an A. I thought we did it right. Wow. But they want more specific details.
Okay.
So, and I've not managed a kitchen before.
Yeah.
But I have the information that they need, with the exception of the technical details.
Mm-hmm.
How many foot candles did the lights put out? No electrician.
Yeah. Right.
But that's our plan.
You know a good one.
And the kitchen will be rented out?
That is a commercial kitchen. The plan is to rent that out. Yes,
what,
sir.
What does that run approximately, or do you have a price on it?
Hourly? We have not set that rate.
Okay.
I believe 3 years ago it was something like $38 an hour.
It was 35. Is what when I came to and told you, I think is what it was.
And I believe we will revisit that just to make sure that we're, you know, obviously meeting expenses, propane, consumables, that kind of thing. But I believe that figure would be attractive to entrepreneurs that want to get started. So,
thank you.
Any other questions for me?
Thank you.
I hope the rest of your night goes as well.
Thank you.
Cindy's usually fast.
All right. Kim, you're not foreshadowing.
60, the library. Ms. Hoffman.
Excuse me. Just to let you know, our circulation in e-books is going up at least 25% every year so far. Print is staying about the same, which is okay. We now have over 91,000 items in the library, and the computer use is still rampant. For summer reading, we did for 15 weeks, and in the last 2 years, we've gone up almost 200 kids register and participating, so that's exciting. This is the state aid funding that we've been working on. We were under a 5-year contract. We've met that and succeeded. Out of the 92 libraries in the state, we are now ranked 82nd. Yay, we've gone up. And we're above the required amount that the state library requires us to get our aid. Revenue was down last year. We only brought in $7,900 instead of like $8,000 or $9,000, I think was the year before. But we did a new program with MACA doing food for fines. during November, people could bring in food donations for the food pantry, and we would forgive their fines. And almost all of those were children and low-income children, as far as we could tell. A lot of mentors and big brothers and sisters brought in food for their kids. So we forgave about $1,600. So we were excited about that. And we did it again this year. And this year, I think we forgave about $1,100. So that's exciting. State aid has gone up. We are scheduled to receive $96,452 from the state this year. When I came here about 10 years ago, we were receiving $49,000. So we've almost doubled, which is exciting. So my total budget request is $445,702 minus state aid, which is the $349,250, which is what Eric put in, I believe. Yep.
And Liz, minimize this and go to her actual budget document, please. And again, for the current fiscal year we're in, Ms. Hoffman has a budget of $443,890. After going through some things, she requested $449. I ended up funding $445,702. So I mean, it was an increase, and I think some of it, if I remember correctly,
it was supplies
and stuff like that. Yeah, it was under books and publications was the majority of some of the increase in supplies. So again, everyone's budgets were pretty level for the most part. No one was asking for anything outrageous, and you know,
we're happy.
Yeah.
Any questions for me?
I'll ask one. What did y'all have going on tonight?
Folks are there tonight. The tax folks. AARP does free taxes 4 days a week for us.
Oh, okay.
And we were pretty busy all day, too, because there's no school today. So there's still lots of families in tonight.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. You talked about the computer use being rampant. If we get the broadband throughout most of the county, like we're in the process of doing, once that gets there, if yours slows down because so many of them have to come there to have Wi-Fi and things of that nature.
And some of the folks aren't going to be able to afford it. Some might. I mean, I know there's some people that come for, especially the Wi-Fi, right, that would have it at their house if they could get it. So, and they can't get it now. Yeah. So,
I know one in particular is there every day.
Yeah, there's a couple there every day.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next is 22, Registrar, Ms. Pace.
Here we go. I have some documents for the board and for you.
What is this? Just the presentation?
It's the presentation.
Okay.
And some docs.
Okay.
I think there's a folder for each person.
Okay.
Good evening. I'm Catherine Hobbs. For those of you that don't know me, I'm chair of the Electoral Board and Joyce Pace. When we prepared our budget request, you can flip to the next slide, we were operating under a set of laws that has become quickly outdated. We knew that in 2019, next slide, the way absentee ballots were going to be allowed to be passed, we knew that there was going to be a change. The law passed in 2019 made a change that to early voting for a period of 8 days before the election. Currently, voters are allowed to request and cast absentee ballots in person and by mail over a 45-day period before any election. But they have to have a reason. They have to qualify to cast that absentee ballot. The law change that was passed in 2019 made it so that for the 8-day period leading up to any election starting in November 2020, any voter could cast in person, not by mail, but in person, a ballot without an excuse. So we were preparing our budget under that assumption that we needed to be prepared to accommodate in-person voters, early voting, no excuse absentee, for an 8-day period. Since the General Assembly went into session this year, two bills that are very similar have passed in both chambers, in their respective chambers, and it's expected, we don't know, but it's expected that the governor will sign this into law. And we need to prepare to accommodate no excuse early voting for a period of 45 days, the entire current absentee period, but no reason why, over 45 days, not 8 days. So the budget request that we put in doesn't necessarily accommodate all of those changes. And some of those changes show up on our budget, and some of them might show up in other perks because they have to do with facilities. I think Eric's going to have to address that better than I can. I'm sort of here to tell you what the changes are and why the request, why we need, it all equals to money. That's why everybody's here.
After Ms. Pace and Ms. Hobbs goes through the presentation, I'll kind of tell you some things that we've been looking into since kind of getting some of this information.
In person and mail out?
Yeah, so at the 45-day period for no excuse early voting will be by mail and in person, whereas the 8-day period that we had been considering would have been no excuse in person only. So already we're thinking postage changes, postage needs will change. There was another piece of information on that slide that in 2019 law passed that made it so we have to enhance a lot of our cybersecurity technology and all the systems that interact with the voter registration system with the state. So we'll tell you some more about that as we go through this. We anticipate that these legal changes will affect our office space requirements, the security of storing equipment, our parking needs, technology, recertification of voting equipment, which the state has mandated, the staff needs, postage, all kinds of needs. Next slide, please. The current registrar's office lacks sufficient work and voting space, lacks sufficient parking, does not have the necessary security, and does not have storage and access in the same facility for the equipment and materials that we need. Next slide, please. As you can see here, this is the entrance to the registrar's office. While it does have a ramp to meet ADA accessibility requirements, it's really difficult to navigate for anybody with a walker or a wheelchair, and any space where voting occurs has to be accessible to the disabled. Making that right-hand turn or left-hand turn into the office is really challenging. The other slide is the chairs, of space for waiting for up to four voters. Go ahead, I'll take you through these quickly. This is just to show you sort of the cramped quarters that we have. Next slide. We've got space currently to have two voters voting at a time. Next slide. We use the floor to prepare our absentee ballots because we don't have surface area that's necessary. Storage is tucked in all kinds of corners. Go ahead. We use the attic and the stairs to get up and down to equipment in the attic of the building are not easy to navigate. Next slide. We use the old courthouse to securely store some voting equipment there. Here are some slides of all the space we use in the voting in the old courthouse. The old courthouse has environmental control issues, specifically around humidity, which impacts not only equipment storage, when we're thinking about electronic equipment stored where there's moisture, and also because of mold and mildew growth impacts workers in that area. You can just click right on through these to show how much space we have. Changing the humidifiers every day to keep our voting equipment safe. Outside storage. Registrar's office uses a lot of space and needs a lot of space. And a lot of that space needs to be secured because they're ballots, because they're the machines on which our votes are cast are there. So we can predict some of the impacts from these legislative changes because in more than 30 states, early voting has already been adopted. The estimates that I'm about to show you are based on the 8-day early voting period, the state prepared some, did a study to help us estimate what the impacts might be, and that was when we thought we were preparing 8 days of early voting. You can go to the next slide. So North Carolina is a state that has already implemented these changes. Anson County, North Carolina is much like Fluvanna County in that it has a similar number of voters. However, their voter turnout is lower than ours generally. Fluvanna, it's great for us. We have one of the highest voter turnout records year after year in the state. In a presidential election year in 2016, I think we had over 76% turnout. Anson County's turnout in the 2016 election was around 60%. But you can see there that when we just had, you had to have an excuse absentee voting, we had to provide absentee ballots to about 2,000 voters, a little under that. But under the early voting system, without a reason in North Carolina in a similar size jurisdiction, they needed to take care of about 6,000 absentee voters. Okay, next slide. So again, this slide was prepared under that 8-day scenario, but what's key information here is that based on the study with the Virginia
Registrar's Association and the Electoral Board and State Board, a work committee.
There was a working committee. Based on that, they think that we can predict that our voter turnout when early voting makes casting one's ballot more accessible to many more people, that we can expect up to an 85% turnout in a presidential election year. Under the blue lines down here on the bottom, when we were thinking that we needed to prepare for 8 days of no excuse absentee, we were thinking that we needed to be able to accommodate an influx in that period of a lot of voters needing a lot of parking. It's not going to be that in a 45-day no excuse situation, but it's also not going to be even from 45 days out all the way up until election day. People make up their minds as you get closer and closer to election day. They remember that there's an election. It's going to ramp up. If we assumed, I think next slide's okay. So if we don't prepare properly, what we know from other states is that it can be disastrous. There can be really long lines on days before election. The media can cover it. Voters are disenfranchised and disgruntled. We know, based on that 85% figure, that we should prepare for, and the percentage that might cast their votes early, at least 6,000 people to take advantage of this. Some are going to vote in person, and some are going to cast their ballot by mail, and we need to prepare for both. So when I was talking about the parking scenario, if you take 6,000, say that half of them vote in person, that's 3,000 over 45 days, and it's not actually 45 days because that includes weekends. You can assume that 66 people a day, 67 people a day will be coming into the area if it were evenly spread out to vote. We don't have that kind of parking outside here. And then it's not going to be even. It's going to be more closer to election day, so there's going to be days when more than 100 people, well more than 100 people, are coming to cast their vote early. And we have to prepare. Thank you. So the law says that in-person absentee and what we're now calling no excuse early voting can happen in the general registrar's office or a satellite voter center. And we'll tell you a little bit about what a satellite voter center is. The request for a ballot can be done in person, by phone, online, by email, like online through the state's portal is what that one is, and through the mail. And emailed ballots are specific to overseas military and other like deployed people. So because of this high volume of calls, the high volume of mail work, the high volume of people coming into the office to make inquiries about how to do this and take advantage of it, and because of a lot of legal requirements, we're going to need additional staff. And I'm going to let Joyce take over here because we all might think that when somebody calls and says, I'd like an absentee ballot, that we say, okay, and it's all ready to go, and we just drop it in the mail. it's a lot more than that. It's a lot more time consuming because we need to make sure that voters only vote once.
Yes. So we listed the steps. And an average phone call can take from 3 to 20 minutes. We've had people to call, 20-minute call, call back the next day, they don't understand, go through the whole process again. Everybody, like we just had a voter this week, he had a brain injury, so he continued to call, he'd have to go through the process, then he wanted to come to the office, go through it again. So, you know, every individual is different. The average phone call can take from 3 to 20 minutes. With an individual. And so what they're asking is if we'll mail them the application so that they can vote absentee. So that's a whole step in itself to get the application, address the envelope, mail it out. Then when we retrieve the application back in the mail, we go to the post office. Of course, we open it, process it through the database. Then we have to make the ballots, stuff them with the instructions, the envelopes that they go in, take those applications. Well, those ballots have to be logged in the postal certification book, so we have to write all those in that booklet, take them to the post office, and each ballot has to be certified mail, so which is a whole nother process. So we're paying for postage, regular postage, and to certify that mail, which is an additional fee. Then you have to come back to the office, put all of those forms away. Then when we go and retrieve the ballot from the post office, once they mail it in back to the office, it's a whole nother process. So you're getting that ballot back, you're opening the envelope, you're making sure what's in there is supposed to be in there, you have to process it through the database again, then you have to get the ballot application and attach that to the ballot, then you have to safely secure the ballots. So you're doing that for almost 2,000 people.
Currently,
for the last presidential election. So if that's by mail, or if they're coming in person, it's a whole nother process. So they're coming in person. If they come in person, you're still going through the same process. The voter is asking questions. You have to help them with the application. You have to process the application through the state database. You have to retrieve the ballot. You have to help them go through the process of how to mark the ballot. Then they mark the ballot, insert it, you give them the I voted sticker, and then you've got the next person. So you can only really carefully wait on one person at a time, because you saw the pictures of how small our quarters are, and you can only help 1 to 2 people at a time.
So probably most all of you vote, obviously. We know what that experience is like for ourselves, and we know what it's like at the polling places, and it's one key difference between voting absentee and voting at a polling place is that the poll books at a polling place aren't lively connected to the voter registration system that the state maintains. They're sort of sequestered off. They're not ever connected to the internet. They're updated right before the election so that all that information that the registrar's office has logged is current, that we know who has requested an absentee ballot and who has actually cast that ballot. When we have 45 days of no excuse absentee or early voting, the people who are keeping track of that have to be entering that information live into the state voter registration system, and they have to be trained to use that system, which is a higher level of skill, and that system requires the enhanced cybersecurity protocols that I mentioned earlier. Because the state also requires that if we offer early voting at a location other than the registrar's office, it always has to be offered in the registrar's office. We can't just do it in one other location. That means that a voter could conceivably cast it someplace else, and then if it weren't live, which it is live, they could then come into the registrar's and on the same day cast again. So that's why the extra training to be connected to have access to the state system is so that we can record this information live and prevent that kind of...
And also, I did not even add the fact that we have to tally every night. So you have to reconcile those ballots to make sure you did not give more ballots than you have or that person was supposed to get.
The public sometimes thinks, oh, it's so easy that somebody could get into the system. It's not easy. We do all kinds of things to make sure that at the end of the day, the number of voters who have checked in by absentee or in person equals the number of ballots that have been issued by mail or in person and at the polling places equals the number of ballots cast in the machine. This is what our democracy depends on, the integrity of the system.
Along with the daily other chores that we have to do. This is just absentee. This is not voter registration. That's still occurring.
There's
and
all
dealing with candidates or whoever else walks in that needs help at the time that you're still doing all of the other things.
Yep. So next slide, please. So let's say we assume that half of these early voters wanted to cast their ballot by mail. We don't know what the proportion is going to be. Let's just assume. Joyce was talking about the steps to the post office. It's 50 cents to mail out just the application. It's 70 cents to mail the ballot because it weighs more. Then you have to certify the ballot because the law says that it has to be sent through certified mail. And then there's the labor associated with that. And the law also requires that all of this happens in a really timely fashion. Joyce can't just spread out this workflow as it suits her. There are legal penalties, criminal penalties. If she doesn't take care, I think it's felony, but it might be misdemeanor, so don't quote me, but I think it's actually felony.
You don't need any more
if she doesn't take care of it in a timely way. So the cybersecurity, we've been working with the IT department in the county because the state has directed that protocols for encryption, access controls to the system, and state data storage be enhanced. These responsibilities are being placed on the counties. The state is doing an audit of all jurisdictions to see which jurisdictions are at which levels to assess who needs what kind of help. We have no idea if funding will come out of that assessment. That hasn't been shared yet. We don't know. We just know that we have to do it. And if we don't do it, they'll cut us off from the voter registration system, which means we can't run an election. So the state is also saying that all the equipment we use has to be passed through a recertification process. And that means all the vendors who supply all of our equipment and program all of our equipment have to go through this process, and that costs them money, which they're going to pass back to us. Tony's just eating his grapes like it's popcorn. we think that this could lead to excessive overtime for existing staff. One other law that is passed in both houses, or legislation that's passed in both houses and is likely to be signed, is that Election Day is going to be a holiday. That's kind of a minor bump in overtime pay for what we're thinking might come down the line. In-person voting is going to require staff to service the centers, or if we're in a space where it's going to take staff to take care of all these people. And the new voting regulations will increase the number of employers needed to process the mailing of the ballots as well. I should catch up on my own screen here so that I can see what I'm talking about. In summary, what we're saying is the registrar will need some additional staff. We're estimating it at two temporary seasonal office assistants. And I don't know what the proper language is for that, whether that's permanent part-time or recurring temporary time. I think Eric's going to have to help me with that.
You need additional part-time dollars is what you need to flex throughout the year.
Yes, because this will happen over a 45 to 90 day period before each election. Some years we only have one election because it's 45 days for each yeah. 45 days.
Every primary is 45 days beforehand.
Every election.
Yes, so this year we're in a cycle where we have three elections. We've got November that we all know about. We also have March next week and June this year. Some years we only have two, some years we only have one, and we often have to prepare to have a June primary that will sometimes get canceled. So one thing I'm sort of going to plant plant a bug in your ears now, is that because these kinds of changes are happening and more are likely to happen in future General Assemblies sessions, that it, should we ever have carryover funds, I think it would be prudent to, when Joyce comes, if she comes, and requests that we carry over any unused dollars because we didn't have a primary. We've already taxed everybody based on having to prepare for a primary, but that's a good way to make sure that we have a contingency fund to deal with the kinds of changes that they're gonna be throwing at us, because what I've just described is maybe it's more than the tip of the iceberg, but that's not all we expect.
And I'm sure we got a bunch of money from the state since they put all these new mandates on.
They're doing an audit, but we don't know what's going to come. They might just say, oh, well, 60% of the state's not ready. We don't know.
The 45 days, though, that doesn't go into effect, wouldn't go into effect until the November.
Until November. Okay. Yeah.
Which actually absentee voting starts in September.
Yeah. So we're talking about needing to be prepared for big changes come July and August in order to be able to accommodate law starting in September. So we think that the registrar needs a larger office, more physical space. We need to have proper security for the voting equipment and ballots. We need to think about parking because of the recertification process, and also if we expand to an alternative center, we may need more voting equipment to accommodate voting in different locations and just the sheer number of voters who might come in. We need to be mindful of safety for voters and staff, and we have to do a lot of training for our officers of election. So that's another way that the registrar's office and board of elections uses space. And I've kind of been hinting at a lot of this. The potential impact of our unmet request is that voters will be grumpy, there'll be disenfranchisement if we don't meet these needs, there'll be negative press coverage, staff will be demoralized, we'll probably end up paying overtime pay, and we'll need to figure out traffic control right outside here. So we have some choices, and we're giving you a hint of what we think of some of the choices here. We can maintain the status quo, which might mean there's storms on the horizon. We can establish a satellite voting center, or we can relocate the registrar's office. Now, maintaining the status quo and staying here, Joyce and I were talking just today about we could maybe expand. We could take care of a lot of this by if she got more space on the village campus. Perhaps we use the Weaver Building a lot, so that's possible, but it doesn't deal with the number of people who might come and the parking, and it doesn't necessarily deal with ADA compliance. But it would possibly allow us, maybe for an interim period.
Potentially help with the accessibility to the basement. We still have the storage issue and the
environmental control issues of storing in the basement. But it might get us through November if we had to, because perhaps all this process of mailing out ballots, all of that space could be used if it could become dedicated space. It would require some enhanced security to wherever it is, because we can't leave that kind of equipment out where the public can just break a window. So a satellite option, which we kind of hinted at as a possibility, this is what we were leaning towards when we thought that we only needed to plan for early voting over 8 periods. We thought that this might be ideal, and I don't know that we think it's ideal now, but it's an option. This would be a location open only during the voting period for each election. I mentioned that it has to maintain the same hours of the registrar's office, and the same services have to be offered in the registrar's office. It would need secure internet lines. That would be mandated by the state. The building would need to have security access controls on it. And the officers of election who'd work there would need to be trained to that higher standard that I mentioned earlier. And we'd need to have additional equipment to operate in a new location. If we relocate, everything could be centrally located in one area. We wouldn't have to spend all our time moving things from one place to another. There'd be working space for personnel. We wouldn't have to be on the floor. We might be able to have training in the same facility. We could plan to have modern security. It would, we'd have to identify a place with ample parking. It would have to accommodate the voters. It would have to be, it's required that it's ADA accessible. It'd need to be in proximity to the registrar so that she could solve any problems, or she would be on site. But she could also, ideally, it would be, I sort of misspoke there since we're talking about if they're all in one space. If we had staff working with the voters who come in to vote in person, and there was another space where they could deal with the mailed-in applications, but it was big enough that Joyce could just do all of the work that's still required to maintain the office that's always going on in the background, not because she doesn't just do absentee ballots, then she wouldn't have to be called in to every problem, like is what happens now, because her desk is right there in that small space. When the voter comes in and there starts to be any kind of concern, they just pop their head in. So she gets interrupted a lot, and when you get interrupted a lot, any of this work, it's not the kind of thing where we can afford to make mistakes. So new, bigger space might solve some of those issues, and we may not have to buy as much new equipment if it were all in one space. Was that the last one?
Okay.
All right. So do you have questions?
So just a little backdrop. So the current space that the registrar's office is in, the square footage is, I think it's 962 square feet. Does that sound about right, Calvin? I think 962 square feet. And they also store a lot of their voting equipment in the basement of the historic courthouse. They use about 500 square feet for the storage of their equipment and some other stuff. So right now they're using about 1,500 square feet. And you know, if you go by the pictures and you go by the storage, 1,500 square feet is probably not adequate to do what they need to do. So just as an example, you know, we've been trying to look around, and believe it or not, and Mr. Rothmel and I were looking at some other spaces to rent, because we don't really have any options for county buildings at all in anywhere in the county to relocate them, because we're just tapped out. We looked at some other spaces to rent, and there's not a lot of space to rent that's somewhat centrally located. So the first thing that we looked at, we were looking for a commercial space. We looked up at the Jefferson Center right up there by where Villanova's is. They have two 1,100 square foot spaces, and for both of those spaces, so I assume that both of those spaces would be required to accommodate the needs of you know, her existing space and then growth. That's about $3,800 a month for rent. So that's $45,600 a year. That doesn't include whatever type of upfront build out would need to occur in the space. I mean, because the spaces are normally not, you know, they're just kind of blank slates for the most part. And then, you know, you're going to have new costs for utilities and stuff. Now there may be some offsets for utilities, but you know, if the county is still maintaining the building, keeping the building, there's not an offset. So I think on the front side, you're talking easily, this is just from a facility standpoint, you're talking easily, and like I said, we're trying to get other quotes for rent too, and we're going to have to look around. You know, I know there's an open space over, Lake Center over across from where the Dogwood is, and we have to see how much square footage there is, but there is not a lot of space available. We even ran by the St. Peter's and Paul today, because the school that they have is no longer operational, and we went there to see what type of space they have, and it wouldn't accommodate what their needs are. So, you know, we're talking easily $50,000 a year from a facility standpoint, and then, you know, probably a one-time upfront cost of, you know, $25,000 to $50,000 to get the space up to what it needs to be, and that doesn't accommodate, and that doesn't take into account either, you know, what are her actual staffing dollar needs. So, you know, when this budget was prepared, the 45 days wasn't, because it was so far out there, it really wasn't a thing at the time, and now it's pretty much pushing forward. So I think from her budget standpoint, and and I don't know how much wiggle room there is within here. I think maybe they may need some additional personnel, and we'll have to see what the 45 days actually does, and maybe that's where the BOS contingency comes into play if we find out throughout the year that, you know, they're running short on this or that. But if we decide that we need to relocate, there are going to be some new upfront costs.
So one of the postage in here wasn't planned with the 45 days in period in mind. We were planning to accommodate redistricting, which is also going to be more work than usual. That just happens every 10 years, but as voters get switched from one precinct to the other, there's a lot of mail associated with that, and so we've increased a little bit there, but it will need to increase more. Trying to think what else. You all should know that we can't just up and move the registrar's office. That's not something we can do at a last minute. There's a chance that the Justice Department might have to give us pre-clearance in order to relocate it, so it's something we need to work on pretty quickly.
Here's one question. You talked about if we expand to another place, we'd have to buy more machines. Can we use existing machines? I don't know how easy they are to move or anything like that. There until the day of the election, and then transfer them from that extra place to one of the polling precincts.
No, we do have some spare machines, but we can't use. You can't use a.
Good.
Well, so we by law there would have to be one operating. We currently run. People can come in person now with an excuse. They can do that.
Right.
So there's currently, we have a machine that's in the registrar's office, but the law would require that we would have to have, continue to operate it, and then we'd need a new machine for the new location. And once we start running ballots for that precinct, which we call like the satellite voting precinct.
Oh, so it would become its own precinct. That was my question.
Yeah.
Because the day of the election, hopefully they wouldn't have to use those spot locations. They would go to the...
Right, but we won't be able to take that machine and okay. Then go use it over at 101.
Wouldn't it be conceivable that if we're expecting, let's just say, hypothetically, you moved to a new location, the registrar's office was in a new location, is it conceivable that the actual voting occurring on actual election day and the amount of machines needed at those locations may be lessened, which then could use those machines at...
We only use one at each precinct, and then we only have three.
You're talking just the one scan machine.
The scan machine, and then the number. So, theoretically, say, it is...
You can't close the polls.
We can't close...
the election day.
Yes, so...
So those machines are attached with the ballots inside.
After the first or second year, we would know whether or not we should plan to have the same number of staff that we always have, the same number of officers of election and the polling places on election day. Right now, we don't know whether or not we'll be able to cut the number of staff. One cut that we probably could make on the fly, though, is once we know 50% of the voters have already cast their ballots, we might, within the last week, be able to cut the number of officers of election. But I don't think that we could cut the number of poll books that we send. We only send 4 poll books to each, one for the chief and 3 for three for the line, and then there's only one scanning machine, and then we have spares, not sufficient for every precinct, but I could, if somebody's scanning machine stopped working, the board can run a backup machine to them. But so I don't think that we could cut the number of computers and the number of scanners.
Yeah, I didn't mean necessarily cut them, but if they could be allocated in a different way, that's...
We occasionally operate with just 3 poll books instead of 4, but you can't operate with one less than one scanner. We could operate... possibly with less staff, which we do for primary elections. We don't have the same number of officers of elections running them.
We know about next year? Not November, but next March? Are we going to have no more primaries again in March and June?
Not in March. March, we only have them in March for presidential. We have June. Then there's special elections of some county elected person. Like, that's something that we always...
You know, like the town of Columbia that time.
Yeah. Yeah, we do know, and we we always have to prepare for a June primary, but we don't know until, not only until there's, like we learned today, that the both parties have declared a primary in June for the Senate, and there's congressional primaries too, but we won't actually know up until the last day for candidates to file to run in a primary, whether or not we'll have one in Fort Anna. That's why, like, we always have to budget for it, and you don't know until the last minute whether or not it's going to happen. Because you can't be unprepared for an election.
Going back to locations, if the board said, you know what, move the registrar to a new location so all operations are there, you know, we were trying to look at locations that are, you know, somewhat central, and that's kind of tough because this area is pretty much mostly central, and there's just nothing here. So the next most obvious, we were kind of looking up towards the lake because, you know, it's not that it's necessarily central, but it's kind of a slightly more towards a population center. You know, the only other options we could do is if the board wanted to go that direction, we'd either have to go to Fort Union or look up at Zions Crossroads, which both of those options too are, you know, not necessarily centrally located, so.
When we were thinking to plan for 8 days, we were very concerned about location because we didn't want any voters to believe that we were trying to favor one population over another. And because if we did do that, it could impact voting results. If proximity and over a short period were closer to some voters than it were to others. So we really liked the library as a central location in the county for a satellite location when we were thinking about a short period of time. I'm a little less concerned when people have 45 days to get to somewhere in the county about how location will impact who has access to voting, just because they've got more time to make an extra trip from Scottsville, say, to Food Lion Shopping Center.
I'd look at Fort Union also. I don't think Fort Union's any more less centrally located than the lake is. And that might be a way to put something in one of the businesses.
I mean, the ideal spot has a business in it, but that First Run Cafe is like perfect.
Yeah. It doesn't have a real business in there now. Well, it's just catering.
So if they wanted, if they could be tempted away, it's perfect. Because if you start getting far away from the post office, then the number of trips, like mileage, right now they're walking to the post office. Then you have to think about how much time, and not just mileage, but labor hours they spend going back and forth to the post office.
And they'd have to use this post office?
Well, it's the only central.
No, there's a post office in Fort Union.
I mean, if you were in Fort Union, that's what I'm saying.
Post office.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking to travel.
Or Troy.
Yeah. Any post office.
Yeah. So what's the board's initial kind of thought about
location?
Do we have any other options other than what you've told us about?
Well, I mean, like I said, you could look at two different locations. I don't think that's necessarily the best option. I think one, as it stands right now, where the equipment is, where her office is, and what has to occur to get the equipment situated. I mean, you know, we got public works guys lifting yeah, all this stuff from out of the basement, out of stairs. There's no.
What about downstairs? Could that be renovated?
You know, we had talked about that.
The basement.
The basement here. Like I said, the parking's still going to be an issue because you're still in this area. It's not like you have a lot of additional parking. I mean, could it work? I don't know. I think there would be a lot of work that would need to occur in that basement to even get it remotely ready for that. So
these two spots you're talking about is really more than we need.
I think these two suites are right next to each other.
Okay, and they're more than what we need. One is not big enough.
Right.
No, two of them would probably. It's probably a little bit more than's needed than we need, but I'm not sure. I don't know what type of additional space requirements.
Half of the one. Yeah.
When you were talking about square footage, we've got a storage barn behind the registrar's office, and we store stuff up in the attic too.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the two suites would probably be the space that's needed, and it would give them some some
right.
open training space and some open voting space.
The grocery store.
That's 17. The grocery store is 17. It's not.
That's the only,
right.
only one.
The other,
that was my first thought where the grocery store closed down.
17 square feet, right? Yeah. I mean, it's
17,000.
Oh, yeah. Where the grocery store closed down?
Yeah.
It's 17,000?
It's about that.
That's
Brian said. Mr. Sheridan, then you get into this is where we get into those issues that you all are going to have to consider when you, with the location. Like we already hear from voters who complain, who are in Cunningham and the Lake, and they complain about having to vote in Antioch. They're like, that decision is y'all's.
Well, trust me, I know that. Very well, because they can drive 12 miles in either direction from my precinct to get there.
And one
of them, they can drive about 17 miles.
I hear the complaints, and I try to take them graciously, and then I remind them of our school children who ride the bus both ways every day, not just on election day. But
the one at the lake is the best place.
When you're thinking about the cybersecurity and the internet technology, the lake then starts because there's just more services there, that becomes a little more appealing. I should say that with the cybersecurity enhancements, one of the things that we're hearing from the state, and it's all just kind of rumor, is that they, because of the access controls to the system, they're concerned about all county employees' access to it is public knowledge that Russia did try to get into Virginia's voter system in 2016, so they're very concerned about access corruption within the entire county system, any point of entry to the internet system. So what they're sort of hinting at is that one of the least expensive ways to meet those standards would be to sequester the registrar's office on its own internet system, so that the rest of the county doesn't have to make the same upgrades.
Well, it wouldn't be on our network there. I mean, any satellite office is not going to be on
everybody else's network.
Well, it wouldn't be Wi-Fi. It'd have to be hardwired, right?
Andy's been intimately involved with some of this cybersecurity.
Yeah, we could sequester off their network fairly easily and have it would still go through our router and firewall, but it would be all separated from everywhere else. So, like, mostly because if anything on this network was to get hit, it would be blocked off. It wouldn't be able to make it over there. It's not like we'd build up a brand new internet connection or anything, but we could fairly easily, software-wise, even hardware, I could shut them off from the rest of the network, no problem. I don't think there is a whole lot of stuff they do between on our network anyways, and I have hardware that I could set up their own file server and all that kind of stuff. It wouldn't take a whole lot from the equipment I have on hand to do that. And that's the other thing. But if you do decide you're going to move in someplace else, well, Fort Union does have some possibilities. There's not much connectivity for internet down there.
Right. Yeah.
And they are going to have some level of speed they're going to have. And most of this county doesn't meet just basic broadband. And I know they don't down here.
And that site is not going to be...
That's not far to see.
It's not far to see. No. It's not close enough to make a leap.
Yeah, or the trip they're going to Columbia, I don't think it's close enough for them to reach out to there. So
it's not, yeah.
So these two spaces, oddly enough, you know, they're saying that there may be someone interested in them. But I think now they may just be saying that.
So we can...
I know, I'm sure they would probably be happy for... Yeah. County to get into that space.
Campaigns get interested in those spots, so you're going to want to get them before the campaigns do.
But that's, you know, like I said, that's kind of the direction that you know, I need from the board. You know, I mean, I think it's probably needed.
Doesn't sound like we have a choice.
No.
I don't think we have a choice. Yeah. And all you have to do is go down that basement under the courthouse and look at what's going on.
Well, and if we have another issue with the water, with the water, and we might have a backhoe parking there digging up the floor again to replace a pipe.
I didn't show, and I didn't show them on purpose.
Yeah.
But what happens when there's
humidity in the water.
So So if so, we can reach out to the Jefferson Center and let them know that we're interested in looking at their space and then pursuing it more, and we can see what we need to do. If that sounds like a head nod from the board, I think most of the board said probably.
But didn't you say that's got to be approved by somebody? And what about somebody?
They mentioned the Weaver Building, and what's the other building to the right of the courthouse, old courthouse?
Oh, you mean the two small buildings?
Yeah.
My old office, that's where they moved.
Yeah, that's the old IT building and the Weaver Building. I mean, like I said,
there's nothing in either one of those.
There's nothing in them. I mean, they're just meeting spaces. But
the IT building, that's where the Pearl.
Oh, that's right, the Pearl office, Pearl office is in there. Yeah.
That little two-story thing that used to be in that
building's
really bad for anybody.
Mm-hmm. It's just not adequate. It's not adequate space down here. We're just, as I've said a lot of times, we are just tapped out for space.
We still have the parking problem there.
And the parking, yes.
Yeah. I've even wondered about what we call the learning cottages at the schools. Like if that could be a solution, say
the trailers, but we don't have those anymore, really.
But even putting something like that over near the library and across from the sheriff's office, then you get security's nicely taken care of, which is one of the reasons why we favored the library when the eight-day period. I don't have any sense of how much that costs. We do try to be frugal, and that's why Joyce and I were thinking about, like, we could just operate all the mailing stuff out of the Weaver Building if it became an extension of her office, but it doesn't address the parking and the accessibility.
It doesn't address the storage, doesn't address the equipment, it doesn't address the...
I wouldn't vote we'd get by.
She also said something about having to get it approved by somebody. Yeah, but so who would you have to get it approved by?
So the Justice Department might require pre-clearance.
And is it possible to use the library in any capacity?
No, for 45 days, no. Because we're literally...
It's not 45 days, it's 2 months. It's basically 2 months.
It's going to probably be longer than 2 months because there's a lot of time to training prior, a lot of time afterwards. So you're talking 2 to 3 months that you have to have a space completely, taken
up. About 2 months just for the voting part, because if you take the weekends out, it's going to become 60 days.
Yeah. For each election.
For each election.
Yes.
So if it's three elections, you're looking at 6 months out of the year just for the voting part.
I know the board doesn't want to hear this. Yeah. This goes back to my question of we need to start looking at our facilities that we have, because if we have to start... If we have to start paying $50,000 a year for lease payments, rent payments, we're going to need to start looking at our overall facilities.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, though, if the Justice Department has to approve this, and then we sign a lease, then what if they don't approve it? I mean, how much time is that?
Depending on...
You just have to go through a process. It takes a little bit longer to get through to get the approval. But I think that law is going to change after June is what I'm hearing. That's why it's better to be able to say you have a place secured before June, then you wouldn't have to go through as many loopholes.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
But you would get approved, it'd just take longer.
You wouldn't get approved if you were political about where you located it. Or one would assume you may not get approved, just maybe how I should say it.
We have a solution, they'll just give it to us.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like it's... There's just no space, so it's not political. It's wherever we have space.
You're very
young.
But if there were choices, then you chose
political places. Yeah.
I mean, that's the only place. Like I said...
One of the things about this is a lot of our commercial space is occupied.
Well, I'm glad you're earning your paycheck.
So obviously once we start getting into the budget discussion, so I mean, is that three nods from the board to look at it, or
you don't have any choice.
Okay. So we'll start looking at that. We'll engage with Jefferson Center to see what we need to do and we'll get with you all to look at the space as well, and Calvin, I'll probably pull you along too to see what it's going to take to outfit the space, and Andy, maybe you too for some.
Is it the old storage place that you're talking about?
No, it's the corner. It's the old jeweler, the space right next to it. It's like the corner glass one right there.
Okay.
Yeah. Is this where the old movie place is?
Okay.
Yeah, it's between the
nail.
Next to April's nails.
And a Asian cafe.
Next to mailboxes.
So what we'll do, we'll obviously, once we start to get into budget discussions, we're going to have to start changing her budget a little bit to see where that kind of falls into play. The good thing is, since my budget was proposed, there have been some changes. We have some additional revenues. We have some decreases in expenses. We obviously still need to address the schools and how we move forward with that. But
thank you very much, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be in contact.
56, Social Services, Ms. May.
Good evening. So I'll start with the good news. The good news is we're not asking for additional positions this year.
Yay! You sure?
I'm sure. So other than a few budget lines, we ask for a little bit of additional funding just because the cost of business goes up. We met with Mr. Dahl back in December, and so we are satisfied with all of Mr. Dahl's recommendations as far as our budget goes, and we're pretty happy with that. So just a couple of things that I really want to talk about tonight, though. Our budget request for this year, we would ask to maintain level funding and not to cut our budget. For a few different reasons. One, there's a lot of new legislature this year that affects social services. And one of the proposed bills that looks like it's going to pass has to do with SNAP cases. And so as a result, a lot more residents are going to be eligible for benefits, which is probably going to make our caseloads go up. April of this year, there's a new state and federal mandate that we have to offer employment training to certain SNAP recipients. And we're not getting any additional funding for staff to handle that workload. Over the last year, caseloads have remained steady. In some of our programs, the numbers have come down a little, but in other programs, that number continues to go up. Our Adult Protective Services investigations have significantly gone up over the last few months. So, and we still have over 4,000 people in the county receive SNAP, TANF, and or Medicaid through our office. Can you get that?
Oh, sorry.
So, that's okay. And then as of the end of January, we were 58% through the county fiscal year, and we've spent 57.7% of our budget. And that's considering the fact that we've had some vacant positions, too. So our budget is very tight. It's bare bones. So if you cut my budget, I'm going to have to lay somebody off. So the one thing that I wanted to touch on tonight is the governor's proposed budget. And I know it may or may not pass, but what's in the governor's budget is, so there is a crisis statewide with local departments of social services because the salaries are so low and they're in a crisis trying to recruit and retain staff. We kind of share the same problem that the sheriff's office does with trying to compete with salaries in other localities. So it's been a really long time since the state has increased their pay bands for social services staff. And so actually in the governor's budget this year, he has it in there to adjust the minimum pay bands for all social service employees. Family services titles by 20% and all other titles 15%, which only affects one employee because most of our staff are making more than what the state minimum is. However, in the governor's budget, he's proposing a 3% pay increase for all social service employees across the board to address the compression that's going to be caused when the minimum state salaries come up. And so I've got a couple slides here in a minute that I'll illustrate how that's going to work. We've gotten a letter from the state that says if this gets approved, the total cost would be $68,000. The state match is 84.5%, which is the $57,000. If it is approved, this is a permanent allocation. And the local match would be 15.5%, which would be $10,600. So, and right now, the Senate Finance Committee is in support of adjusting the minimum pay bands, but wants to put off the 3% pay increase until the following year. The House Appropriations Committee is recommending a 1.5% to adjust minimum pay bands, an additional 1% pay increase, a 1% one-time bonus in September, and a 2% pay increase in July of next year. So when it's all said and done, I don't know what is going to come with this, but my request is whatever gets approved, that you would allow us to accept that state funding and cover the local match so that we could give those pay increases to our staff to address the compression. And so what I did, because Mr. Dahl mentioned in his presentation considering a 2% cost of living increase for staff. And so I know in past years, even though we could have gotten a higher state increase, our department has accepted what the rest of the county got so that it would be consistent across the board for all the county employees. So I just wanted to show you the difference if that happened. So so to go from a 2% to a 3% increase, the total difference is $22,000. It would cost the county $3,481 to give a 3% opposed to the 2%, but if you gave the 2%, you'd be turning down almost $19,000 in state funding.
Kim, and that would be effective to July 1st, correct? Because there was some other discussion that it may be sooner, and has that kind of fizzled out?
No, it would be July 1st.
Okay.
Or, July 1st.
July 1st of this coming year.
Yeah, it would be for the new fiscal year.
It's not like what they're talking about with the teachers of putting it off until we're going to save $50 million because we're giving 3% next July 1st.
No, So the governor and the House is talking about giving it this year, and the Senate
is talking about putting it off till 21.
So we won't know for sure until the state budget is approved what that's going to look And so this came from the Virginia League. I just copied and pasted it. This came straight from the Virginia League of Social Services Executives. That is the organization that's made up of social service directors, and we meet regularly. And so we asked the governor to include this in his budget, and this is all the reasons why. At the state, they've done a salary survey, they've done a third-party market study looking at local social services salaries and how far behind we are for comparable Virginia Department of Social Services positions. And then it looked at the turnover in 2019, and this is across the state, this isn't specific to us, but the turnover rate for Family Services Specialist 1 positions in 2019 was 35%. And so this is why we've asked for to increase our salary ranges and to address the compression. The impact on Fluvanna, and I'll show you another slide in just a moment to illustrate this, but so when the state minimums go up, which it looks like they will because the governor and the Senate and the House all support it, so when that happens, currently right now, our minimum salaries are higher than the state's. But there's some surrounding localities that still go by the state minimums. And so, for example, we pay more than Buckingham and Cumberland. So we have a lot of employees at our office that are from Buckingham and Cumberland because we pay more than they do. What's going to happen when the state minimums go up, then our salaries will go up to match the state minimums, and we'll be the same as everyone. So we're not going to have that competitive edge in order to be able to pay more than some of the other localities. And whatever the state does end up approving, I can guarantee you that other local social services are going to accept it. And so if we don't, that's going to put us further behind as far as trying to be competitive with other local departments of social services. I've talked with our state representative, and they've not heard from any locality that they would be turning down any of the state funding. So the next slide, this shows what our salary ranges are and what they're going to be. So if you look at the blue, that's what our current minimum salary is, and this is our administrative positions. The red is the current state minimum. So you can see we're slightly higher there than the current state minimum. And the proposed state minimum is the green. So you're going to see, so us and every other local social services is going to go up to the green. And the next slide just shows our, this is our benefit positions. And then the next slide, this is our services positions. And you can see that our minimum is quite a bit higher than the current state minimum. But with the new state minimum, those are going to go up as well. And so when this happens, it's going to cause, it's going to result in compression. And this is one example, and this is actually a real example. So currently we have a benefit program specialist two. In July, they will have been with the agency for 2 years. They've completed all of their state mandated training. They're proficient in SNAP and Medicaid, and they make $34,000 a year. They probably started at 30. So when the minimum salary for a benefit program specialist goes up from $28,000 to $32,415, in July, if we hire a new benefit program specialist with no training, they're going to be at $32,415. But next slide. Fast forward 1 year. This worker now has been with the agency for 3 years. Now they're proficient in SNAP, Medicaid, TANF, ABD, and long-term care Medicaid. But with no pay increase, they're still at $34,000. Benefit program specialist two, this person, well, now they've been with the agency for a year. They've completed their mandated training. They're only proficient in SNAP and Medicaid. But they got their end of trainee promotional increase when they went from a 1 to a 2. So now that puts them at 35.7. So now this person's making more than this person. Next slide. Give this person a 2% increase, they're still making less. Next slide. Give this person a 3% increase, they're still making less. So there's going to be compression. So this is why I ask, whatever the state gives us, please let us take it. And this is the last slide. This is just to, I like to show you every year how much money we bring into the county through our office. And so the amount of money spent on Flubana Social Services in fiscal year 19 was $31 million. And this includes the state and federal contribution to our budget and what they pay out to our residents and benefits and services. So the locality's share of this is $1.2 million. So the $1.2 million that you invested in us brought back $31 million. And I also have for each of you, for Eric and all the supervisors. So this is a profile report that the state puts out specific to our agency every year. So I just wanted you to have a copy of that. And you'll see that the numbers, the $31 million, that's on the last page of the profile report. The numbers are a little bit different because that's because the profile report includes CSA numbers, and I took the CSA numbers out. questions?
Thank you so much, young lady.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Last but not least is number 35, Mr. Lai, Fire and Rescue Association.
Thank you for having me tonight. I know it's getting late, so I'll try not to go on for too long. Like everybody else, we're facing the same kind of financial pressures that everybody else is. Medical supplies are going up faster than inflation. Diesel fuel is going up, bandages, electrodes, all that. But I do want to talk about something. So, you know, we do have the operational budgets. But I do want to focus on something else. Can we go to the next slide? We're talking about funding operational budgets for fire services, which at this point is 100% volunteer in Flavanna County. Next slide, please. As well as rescue services, which is currently a mix of contracted career staff as well as volunteers. Next slide. As well as water rescue, which again is 100% volunteer. And so I won't dwell on it, but one of the big things that I'd like to point out is the amount of volunteer time is saving the county a huge amount of money. And I haven't run the numbers, but it's you can do it yourself. It's a lot of money. So one of the priorities of the Fire Rescue Association is retaining, not only recruiting new members, but retaining the trained, committed, vibrant volunteers we already have. We have a very strong volunteer force in this county, which not all the counties around us can claim. And so two of the proposals that we put up this year, which did not get through the county administrator's budget that I'd like to mention at this point, are some retention initiatives, one of which we've talked about several times in the past, which is the personal property tax relief. And Emergency Coordinator Smith with the Finance Department's help put some numbers together for that. And that's in red, second from the bottom. One of the other issues is that firefighters are particularly prone to getting line of duty cancers of various kinds. And we would like to include a cancer policy on the health insurance, particularly for firefighters who are exposed to these chemicals in the course of their duty. And that's the bottom line there. So I'd like you to consider that to help us retain the committed and vibrant volunteer force that we have now. We've got a lot of time and money invested in these volunteers, and we hate to lose them once they're trained. And that's really the big push that I wanted to bring up to your attention tonight. If you can go to the last slide. One of the other questions that has come up in the past over several years is, why is Lake Monticello's operational budget so much higher than the other budgets? And I've had this conversation with several of you at various times, which is that we've never been able to do an apples-to-apples comparison, because there are a lot of incidental hidden expenses that the county pays for some of the other agencies that the lake pays for directly. And so with the help of the finance department, and they did a spectacular job getting these numbers, because they're buried in various other budgets, that's the analysis you see here. And if you look at the very bottom line there, in fact, once you do an apples-to-apples comparison, the costs end up being about the same, and the number of calls is about the same. So that's kind of what I've been maintaining for years. It's nice to see that those numbers bear me out. So at that point, that was really the gist of my presentation. I would like to thank you all for your support in the past and continuing support, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
How many people do we have that volunteer for rescue?
For rescue, at Lake Monticello, currently, I actually didn't check the most current roster, but it's approximately 80, and another approximately 20 at Flavanna County Rescue. So about 100 countywide, and I believe it's about 150 firefighters countywide at this point.
That's so, including lifetime members?
Yes. I believe that.
No, that is not.
That's just active members for fire.
That's active members, correct.
Yeah.
How about for rescue, though?
Rescue, those are those. Well, I can't answer the county, but for a lake, that does not. That's only people that are actually running.
Okay.
Yeah. Water rescue has a big overlap with rescue as well.
So
you said 80 people from Lake Monticello?
Yes, ma'am. And approximately.
And do they go out all the time?
Yes. Okay. Those are people that are actively running calls. Not all of them are 100% on duty shifts, but some of them are associate members who are picking up calls as needed.
And do you work with the other, the hired rescue people as well?
We interact with them on a daily basis, yes, ma'am. Generally, so we have first due areas, which is our primary responsibility each, but if, for example, if the contracted crew picks up a call in Kent's store and another call in Fork Union comes out, which would be their first due, but they're already out on another call, the lake will take that call. And vice versa, if the lake unit is on their way to the hospital, the patient, the contracted crew will come into the lake and pick up those patients. So we all cover the entire county, but we each have our primary responsibilities. Does that make sense and answer your question?
Somewhat, yeah.
Okay.
I think maybe the question might be, if we've got 80 rescue volunteers, where is the shortage in volunteers in terms of rescue? Because that seems to be one of the driving things that we've talked about.
So
they must be used in different ways that we don't understand.
Well, part of it is the demographics of it. We used to have a lot of young retirees who were available during the day. Now our demographics have changed such that we primarily have people like myself and Chief One who work during the day. And so we're available at nights, but not so much during the day. And so some of our night crews might have four people on it, where the day crew just has two. And so that's a big part of it, is just availability.
It's a lot easier to get a second crew out at night than than it is to get one during the daytime.
For exactly that reason, a lot of us are at work somewhere.
Mr. Lai, could you talk a little bit about, just since you're familiar with it, so in my budget I propose to have a second contract crew Monday through Friday, 12 hours a day. Can you speak about the need for that, or what your thoughts are on that? Obviously, I've talked to a bunch of the chiefs. So.
Yeah, so we discussed that. Call volume is not going down. Call volume is increasing. And traditionally, about two-thirds of the calls are during the day and about a third are at night. Daytime is where we have the pressure for getting volunteers out as well. And we have larger call volume during the day as well. And at some point, as we get closer to this, I'm going to pull an analysis. Now, we can see exactly where those are. I've done it in the past, but I'd like to do it with some newer numbers. Approximately 7 to 7 or 8 to 8 seems to be about the peak of where things are. And so we'll have to adjust that with the contracted crew as to when it is. But call volume is coming out. We are getting more second and third due calls than we ever used to have. And so 6 months ago, I wasn't so sure we were ready for having a third crew during those 12 hours. My opinion on that has changed. It's gone up, and I think we're probably at the stage where we need it now.
And I think there's some days Lake Monticello has trouble finding a crew during the daytime, aren't there? Not often. I mean, just sometimes.
Sometimes, and we've been addressing that, and right now we're actually, we've had some folks step up and do that. I think that problem is solved, at least
temporarily. Well, we don't want to wear them.
And we don't want to burn them out.
Right, exactly. You knew what I was saying.
Yeah, and we don't want to burn them out. But we also have an EMT class coming with some folks specifically targeting daytime crews. And so that will also help relieve the pressure. But it's going to be an ongoing pressure no matter what.
What percentage do you have that you don't transport people? You get to the house and they say, I'm not going. I don't need to go. Do you have a high percentage of...
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but anecdotally, sort of off the top of my head, 20 to 25% probably. Mm-hmm. It's going to be in that ballpark.
Yeah, I was reading where one state has a nurse practitioner on duty, mm-hmm. and when they call in, they can go to the nurse practitioner rather than having a squad, and that is saved. A lot of money. I know we're not at that level.
We're not at that
right
level.
Now.
There are some initiatives for community paramedicine
uh-huh.
as well,
right.
Where you'd have a paramedic doing that sort of thing, and they could go out to the house and address the questions and then call a transport ambulance if needed or as not. paramedic is cheaper than a nurse practitioner, for example.
Right.
And so statewide, there are programs like that that are being explored, and I think at some point we're probably going to need that. I don't think Fulvana County is quite ready for that mm-hmm. yet, but it would definitely alleviate some of the pressure, especially for the refusals.
I was going to say probably one of the biggest calls we get that's a refusal, Ms. Booker, would be when somebody's fallen.
Right. Yes.
And they need a lift assist.
They just need a lift assist, set them back up in their chair, yeah. and get them back into bed. Mm-hmm. Especially at the lake, that's a large mm-hmm. number of our calls.
What will happen out where we are, in more rural areas, is you'll have people that... Help me out. I'm trying to say this very nice.
Trying to be
diplomatic. Well, they may have something going on physically that they just... They have trouble, and you'll get called to the same house 5, 10, 15 times. I mean, mm-hmm. especially with the fire department, they'll get to where they, and they'll tone the rescue squad to go every time.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and part of that is that if somebody has fallen, it's unknown if they actually need medical assistance, or they say they're fine, but are they really fine? And if a firefighter doesn't have the medical training to make that evaluation, there's a liability issue if they don't look at it. So having somebody with the training there is important. Anything else?
Any questions? Thank you very much. We do appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
And we have one additional one on here too. That so Ms. Rice, we got just a quick summary of health insurance, where our proposals came back. We don't have like in the weeds of like what everything's
good. Before you do that, can I ask Social Services a question?
Absolutely, ma'am.
Okay, Ms. Kemp, the compression that you talked about. I know years ago, I think when I was on the board, we did some things with compression, but we had to give workers a different percentage of raise. Now, can you do that if you get the 3%? Like somebody got 5%, somebody got 2%, just to move them so you wouldn't have that compression. So if you get to 3%.
It's probably going to be in legislature that it's 3% across
and
the board.
And across the board. And is that going to help the compression?
It's going to help. It's not going to solve it, but it will definitely help.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Ms. Rice. She doesn't have a number.
No, I don't. Good evening.
Good evening.
So tonight I thought I would take you through kind of the overview of what came in or where we're at with health insurance. Probably started this process about 5 or 6 weeks ago. And what we did this year was after our third party administrator, we ended that contract, which then allowed us to go out for some different quotes and options for our health insurance. And we got proposals back from 3 different carriers. I'm gonna show you kind of what we have and what we're looking at right now. The first thing I kind of wanted to show you up here was historically what's happened with our insurance premiums overall since 2014. Not the best story, as you can see. Every year it's gone up. Most recognizably in the last 3 years, there's a star by FY18. That is when we picked up Cigna. So for the last 3 years, you can see what our increases have been since we've been with Cigna, since FY18. So basically what the carriers are using to look at to determine health insurance quotes is actual cost of claims, the premiums charged by reinsurers, which are the ones that are capturing the risk above a certain level, how much are we using our prescriptions and pharmacies, what type of drugs are we actually needing for our health conditions, and then administrative fees. Okay, currently, as you all are aware, we're using Cigna Health right now. We do have 3 plans available for staff. There's a $250 deductible, a $500 deductible, and a high deductible health plan. And then we have separate comprehensive dental and vision. And plan funding, the way we're set up right now, is that we are self-insured for every individual in all of their claims up to $45,000 a year. Once we hit that $45,000, another insurer comes in and helps back us up so that we don't end up with astronomical rates at the end of the year. And if the grand total of what they're projecting comes in less of all the people that kind of hit under that $45,000 mark, if we end up underfunding, we actually share some of that cost back to the county. I can tell you that's only happened once in the last 4 years. So basically, our health costs are going up, and this is how we're funding right now and what plans that we do have. All right, three proposals that we went out for. The first one is BPA. That is the school's insurer right now. And the way this works, they are using a part of the Cigna network. They have separate plans available for dental and vision. It is a self-insured plan. And so what they came back with ended up being a 1.3% increase. You can see the numbers at the top there. And what it looked like when we were reviewing it was that they basically were going to diminish our reserves, and so our total plan cost would end up looking less. That was the paper that we had in front of us. The second one, our current carrier proposing 19.47% increase. Again, this is our present carrier. We have access to the full Cigna network, the level funding like I was talking about. Again, this is a self-insured model and with separate plans for dental and vision. And then we also reached out to the local choice. And what this is an Anthem network. It's a governmental pool. This is what we had before we went to Cigna. The dental, vision, and EAP are all included. And it is pool funded, which means that we have access to resources from all the other governmental entities in the state. This was the quote they gave us, and they're looking to decrease us by 21.74%, or about $350,000 for the year.
When's the party?
So let's just kind of
finally,
that's kind of the brief overview of what we're looking at, and obviously there's a lot of work to do in figuring out how that would be divvied up between county and staff and what the impact of that would look like.
The one thing I will tell you, and this is the one thing we are still having to look at, because overall it's going to be a big increase. But you remember when we went from the local choice to Cigna, we had three plans with the local choice. We had employee, dual, and then family. And dual could mean employee plus one or employee plus spouse, employee plus one child or employee plus spouse. But if you're employed with two children, you'd have to go to the family plan. Now,
we're working on some different options.
To try and see if there's a way to hold harmless with having such a big decrease. I think there's a way we might be able to structure it, and Jessica, like I said, we've been kind of working through just some of this, and we just kind of got some of this information back, so we don't have it all completely fleshed out yet, but I can tell you right now, I think we have about 140 people on the insurance.
Yes.
I think there's about 20 employees that are on the employee children plan. Now, but I don't think all 20 of those are employee children. Some of them may be employee child. So that's what we have to figure out. What is that number of the employee children? And there's some choices we made. If say they have to move to the family plan, well, with the rates dropping so dramatically, do we maybe lower the family plan? So if they can kind of transition into that where it's maybe not a cost, or maybe there is a cost because maybe they bring their spouse on the plan. Those are some of the things that we're going to bring to the board to look at. But, obviously some other things to look at is, well, the county's been paying the increase every single year. is it that we want to share in the decrease? You know, we've kind of had this nominal percentage that the county covers for the different plans. You know, kind of employee only, it's in like the 90% range. Employee plus children and dual, it's been around the 80% range, I think, and then a little bit less than that for family. So, you know, you can either, the county gets sees the benefit of the decrease, both the employees and the county see the benefit of the decrease. But like I said, we still have to look at some of those employees that we're not going to have that kind of fourth option to see how we can fit that all in. And we're not saying that's the way to go, but I would assume that the board would think that may be the way to go.
There's a couple of things I kind of want to point out on here. Sorry to...
No, go.
But the first thing is that these were just three options that came back. This is not my recommendation, but we can go out and get quotes for fully insured, like Optima or Aetna or one of those, if you want to see another number. So if we were to do something like that, I would kind of need to know that really quickly to get that out and about. I had to issue an RFP for that. Also, if that's the case, now we're talking about looking at this implementation timeline, even to switch over to the local choice. There's kind of some additional steps in there. We have to get BOS approval for the application and all this other stuff. And so there's a lot of different components to this. I didn't want to get into all of the minute details until y'all were kind of ready to discuss it a little bit further. And then again, like Eric was talking, we've got how do you break down the premiums and all of that. I'm sure you recall that from previous years. And then also plan design changes. There's some different things we can do to even help mitigate our costs even more. And so kind of with that, that's where we're at. If the board wants to see a more detailed version of what the proposals are, I can bring that forward as early as next week. If you're okay with just starting to crunch numbers on a specific plan, we can do that too. That's kind of your call to make at this point. So,
local choice and crunch numbers is my vote.
Go.
The local choice.
Crunch go. Numbers. Go back to that slide, please, Liz.
I don't know, the green number wasn't real pretty, right?
Again, there's options. We can certainly, and I can bring more details of that proposal.
And just remember with the local choice, with the Cigna plan, you had all these different options.
Yeah. No brainer.
Yeah.
Why are we beating our horse here?
I don't think we're, I would be happy to go with the local choice.
I can't see us getting a number smaller than 21, or bigger than 21% saving.
Yeah, I don't anticipate this being a hook.
No need you going out working.
I think the other one we saw in the numbers was a hook.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And what happened with BPA, and I think Eric and I kind of caught that this week, was we caught their hook, this little 1% thing, and that it was just like shifting numbers around. And I wasn't here when y'all went to Cigna the first time, but looking at numbers and claims, it kind of does look like there was a little bit of fluff in her proposal. And so the thing with the local choice, they gave us data that they actually don't have any more than a 10% swing over the last, like, 8 years.
And I can tell you, too, looking at some of my counterparts that have been on the Anthem of Local Choice, they're... 1 year when we were with them before, we were looking at a 7% increase, and in hindsight, mm-hmm. if we had a 7% increase every year, we would have been
right.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'd say we've learned our lesson, but
yeah,
we fell for a hook because you saw the two increases, yeah. And the one this year is, you know, they're making us a proposal and it's still a 19% increase. You know, so, what would it have been if we had just said, hey, we're going to keep doing this? It would have been 25.
Well, there was a lot of things that came into play. Again, I think our opportunity opened up when we changed out the third-party administrator and some of that other stuff as well.
And the other thing you talked about was it's based on your pool.
Yes.
It's a big pool.
And we got a huge pool.
We do now. Yeah, we do.
So we go to back.
Yeah. And the resources are there. They're going to include our EAP for free, which is not big dollars, but it's really important for our staff too.
So if you remember in my budget right now, I put a 4% increase, and then we're looking at a decrease, depending on how the board wants to fund. And you know, we have to work into, you know, how to account for some of those employees. But we're still going to see a swing downward, which is a positive. So I'm assuming head nods, and we'll move forward with hand for the local choice.
Yes.
Okay.
Sure. Just want to make sure I heard from you.
Okay.
Make sure you're okay when they said 21% decrease.
Do you have any other questions about the proposal itself, or you just want us to start crunching some numbers?
We're crunching.
Right. Got it.
So, Liz, just go to the budget sheet, and I don't know what the board wants to do, how much in the weeds we want to get. So just as a reminder, we have to advertise a tax rate on March
18th meeting.
So after tonight, if we don't do
18th,
yes.
March 18th, you have to have an advertised tax rate at the end of that meeting.
Yeah, if we don't do anything,
that leaves us three meetings. Hash it out, figure out where we're spending and what we're spending.
Right. Yeah, you have three.
Go to the budget balance sheet. So we haven't changed up anything for what we've done in the past. So right now, we are in the columns GH&I, the VOS advertised column. So you can see up top, there's a $214,000 surplus there. So let me go up here. There's been some things that have changed.
In the blue.
Yep,
in the blue sense.
Okay, so the biggest change right now is we've gotten some additional taxable value from the commissioner's office, which accounts for $121,000. Mary, why don't you slide?
I'm trying to take out the math.
Is there more?
There's more. Is there extra?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. So
there's a couple extra sheets.
Liz, are you all the way up? No, you're not. No, all the way up. Oh, there we go. Okay, so here again. So there's some additional real estate of $25,000, some personal property of $121,000. So we basically about have $150,000 in new taxable values, which equates to real property tax revenue, both real estate and property tax revenue.
We got those today. So
yeah, we got those today.
Correct me if I'm wrong, that's still up.
Oh yeah, it should go up.
That's not final numbers.
It's not final. As more stuff comes in, we'll probably get maybe two. I would assume a couple more times we'll get some updates with updated figures. Go down, please. So if you remember at the last board meeting, we were talking about the ZXR project where we're going to need to cash fund that sooner than in this budget process because the debt proceeds are going to run out. So there's subtracting out $2.7 million out of this budget, and then down below there's another offset of 2.7. It doesn't affect the tax rate because it's being funded with fund balance. Also, the board the board approved an increase in convenience center fees last week, which we're going to implement by April 1. So we said $30,000.
And then with the changes, it went down to about 26. So we're estimating 20.
We're going to put 20,000 in there for Wedge to see how the changes work out. So that's a $20,000 increase in convenience center fees. Schools, they've had, and the schools piece too for this $250,000, that's basically a wash too because it deals with their other local funding. And there's no one from the schools here. So I think probably when school folks are here, and I can make sure they can be at the next meeting to kind of discuss their budget and get into that more. But that's just a straight offset of some revenues that they were showing. So go down to the expense section. Keep on going. Stop right there. One thing, there was a new contractual charge under contract services for E911.
It's actually a grant. It's for the phone system, I believe, the TSAP phone system. And there's a grant that we are going to get for that, but it's going to be a $6,000 operational charge every year to run that new phone system. So this is just the operating cost. The grant's going to pay for the actual system, which is a couple hundred thousand dollars.
That's an enhanced 911.
Enhanced 911.
This is not 100% official because the CVR, Central Virginia Regional Jail Board, still has to approve the budget. But I think that with me and Mr. Weaver being on that board, I'm certain that the budget is going to be approved. but there's going to be a reduction in our budget this year. Well, there's a reduction from what I had proposed from the Central Virginia Regional Jail. What they proposed originally, they got back final numbers for health insurance. Their health insurance, they put in 20%, and that ended up coming at 9.88%. They had some actual numbers kind of finally come in for VRS and all that. So what that means is all the localities that are in it, they're going to see basically a reduction from what the original budget proposal. So we reduce the CBRJ budget by about 58. In Blue Ridge too, I still have to go, I think next week I go to the Blue Ridge meeting, and we may have a slight reduction in that one too, just for the Blue Ridge juvenile detention, but it's not going to be much if it's 5,000, 10,000. The building inspections personnel change, where's the other line? It's basically a wash. It was accounting for someone in the proper department. There was one person that was ENS that was in planning and moved to building inspection, so it was just, it's a wash. It's no dollars associated with it. And then the Board of Equalization, we forgot, this is an error on our part. We had worked with the commissioner, so we're breaking out from the reassessment budget in the Board of Equalization. The Commissioner of Revenue is going to basically oversee the reassessment piece of the contract, and then we're breaking out the Board of Equalization, because the Board of Equalization is the board that oversees and makes any appeals or adjustments to any of the reassessments. So we broke those two budgets out. When we broke it out, we forgot to add the 4753 in separate, so it's just, that's going to be an increase of 4753. And then again, there's the schools, that 250,000 I was talking about. The one thing I just added, and it's not in this budget, but it's just there for your for the board's purposes. So the school's request, as you heard last week from Mr. Winkler, was $679,146 over what we funded them last year. And is there anything else down there, Liz?
What is the school funding from the state? You don't have that on there. And it looks like they're not getting
go back to the 21
much of an increase this year.
They're getting
this
a increase, but some of it's going to be.
What's the state?
Go to the revenue.
I mean, we need to put it together to really let people see how much they're really getting.
He said it was 1.1.
No, someplace in the neighborhood
but some
of $1 million.
Additional. Okay, right here.
Little.
$3 million, $2 million, and $1.25 million.
Yeah, they're getting. Yeah, I mean, it was basically a 1.2, I think, is what it was.
Okay. 1.1 something is what they had.
It was a 1.1 net, because there was an increase in one and a decrease in something else.
So we're really saying about 1.3 million total with local and state, with what we're going to chip in approximately. You're saying 250,000.
If we fully fund them, it'd be 1.8.
Yeah, more than.
No, the 250,000. See the other local revenue under schools where it says $700,000 right there?
Yeah.
That's what they get in from, like, grants and things like that from local agencies. Like Walmart sometimes gives them a couple thousand dollars and that kind of thing. They're saying instead of getting 700 this year, they think they're only going to get 450. So we had to take that 250 out of anticipated revenue because they aren't expecting to get $700,000 from other local. That's not us. That's like other agencies that give them money.
Okay.
So go back to the budget balance sheet. So as where things stand right now, without us crunching numbers for health insurance, we're 214,000 to the good.
That's before you take the health insurance.
That's before we take the health insurance,
and not including that school.
And so remember, in my proposed budget, I have 68,000 for a 4% increase for health insurance. So obviously, 68
that
plus
comes back.
Comes
so
back.
You could almost, I mean, I'm not saying this is what we would decide, but even if you plug the schools in and you took all that in, you'd still be at your rate.
And then remember, in my budget, there is, I proposed a 2% COLA for staff, and every 1% equates to around $68,000.
So you already had that factored in.
I have 2% in my budget.
84.
84. Oh, is there, I'm wrong, 84. I apologize, 84. So, you know, going back to what Ms. Mabe was saying, if, you know, if they get 3%, it, you know, we've generally been of the mindset that if all staff get the same, so...
So that's what would that cost us?
Another 84,000.
Oh, another 84.
Yep.
What was in, do we remember what was in the school budget? I know he had a raise built in there.
They had a staff.
He had 2%, yeah. But then he also had anyone who was moving a step would get that step.
The step instead and of,
well, four. It was, if the
it
step
was. Whichever was the best.
Yes, whichever was the highest.
Was the
best. Yeah. Okay. So it averaged out to be over
right.
two.
Between 2 and 5%,
yeah.
So, and like I said, and in addition to coming back with health insurance stuff, we'll come back to, because there may be some folks that need a target raise, that maybe because after you look at them, they're below what their band should
right.
be. Not a lot. And then also, you know, we have to factor in what social services is bringing forward and just some other things, because we don't have that. Is the 3%, does that include them?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, the 2% includes them, but it did not take into account the money that we would get back from mm-hmm. the state.
Yeah. So in our number, in our 2%, it includes them. So there's some mm-hmm. Flexibility in play with that too. We may be able to reduce what we're funding with the state reimbursement.
Now, here's my next question. We're talking about pay raises and stuff like that. Now, 2% did. Have we factored in anything for the what the sheriff was talking about with the deputies trying to
this compression we have not, because I don't know where Jessica and
y'all
sheriff
were
are
y'all
and,
working on something.
I think that's going to come forward during our next budget.
Okay.
Sheriff and I will probably talk through that a little bit, give you an idea where
just seeing where we got wiggle room.
Yeah,
I think you still like probably will, because
that compression
there's
some, is real serious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so overall, I mean, so this, you know, in the co-ed budget, this kind of shows what was not funded, and I don't think there's any departments necessarily that didn't feel that what I funded wasn't appropriate and adequate for their budgets. I mean, obviously, every department and budget could have more and they could do more, but it's just we have to be able to manage kind of with
an additional with personnel was Parks and Rec.
Yeah, so the personnel I included in my budget was, yes.
Scroll down.
You know, go
scroll down.
Those, I included those two.
Oh.
The CSA. Part-time program assistant and a part-time maintenance worker. Now, for the assistant registrar, you know, as she said, she may just need more part-time dollars to flex mm-hmm. with what she needs to do during the swing and primaries
to supplement
and stuff
those
like 2 month
periods when she has to have extra people.
Yeah,
and keep in mind too, this doesn't include $50,000 a year for rent for her either.
Yeah, well, I mean, right. we're gonna have to
if we have to move her
between now and next week. We'll come back with some more, you know, hopefully some more pluses and minuses for the board to work with. Okay. But that's kind of where we stand right now. I mean, we can get into it more, or we can hold off until next week.
Well, what's that leave the tax rate at then?
So go back to
that was a 93.
93.5.
Yeah,
I'm 1 cent.
1 cent. That's the last that I
heard.
100%.
But that has nothing to do with what we found.
My mouth went crazy.
Schools can be covered with that 1 cent.
I'd say probably by the time, if you were trying to do everything, you'd probably be at 1.5 cents.
Above?
Yeah.
So I'm at my proposed tax rate is 93.5. Well, let's just say nominally, let's just say we're at 200,000 to the good right now. That I guess in theory you could say we could decrease it by, you know, 0.7.
A penny's a little over 311,000.
Yeah. Right.
So, but like I said, you know, there's some things like the registrar building stuff that we're going to have to factor in some things to show the board for next week. So. That's where we stand right now, and you know, as time goes on, hopefully the commissioner will come back with some additional updates on taxable values. But I think any other values, I don't think we're going to get any other big surges in revenues elsewhere. So next week we have next week really is kind of when we get into the budget discussions. We've got a few county departments we can take a look at, you know, namely some of the public works and facilities departments. You know, some of their budgets, I didn't fund them fully. And then Parks and Rec also, we generally kind of discuss those. And then we can discuss some CIP, but otherwise we can get right into going down the line and adding and subtracting.
Boom. Well, thank y'all so much for coming out here tonight. We do appreciate everybody showing up. Now, I see a closed meeting written here. Did we have something for closed meeting?
No.
I don't think we do.
No.
All righty. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So made.
Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor? All in favor? Mr. O'Brien?
I always put up the calendar at the end.